The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matze. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there, support the show, and get bonus content. It's a crazy time in the world. The president has announced the president of the U.S., Joe Biden, is not running for re-election. He was pushed out by his party elite. Kamala Harris is now taking his place. Democrats are feeling energized and excited. The Trump campaign, they were coasting. Their man had survived an assassination attempt. And Joe Biden, of course, was the best opponent they could possibly ask for. And now he's gone. And meanwhile, both parties are coming together to welcome arch war criminal, arch evil figure, Benjamin Netanyahu, to Washington. And we're going to cover all that and more in today's show.
Yeah. So for Democrats suck, let's take a look at how Democrats reacted to Netanyahu addressing the halls of Congress. And let's take a look first at Netanyahu so we have a sense of what we're dealing with.
Many anti-Israel protesters, many choose to stand with evil. They stand with Hamas. They stand with rapists and murderers. They stand with people who came into the kibbutzim, into a home. The parents hid the children, the two babies, in the attic, in a secret attic. They murder the families, the parents. They find the secret latch to the hidden attic, and then they murder the babies. These protesters stand with them. They should be ashamed of themselves.
And then, of course, we're saying that Netanyahu gets one of his many standing ovations from this bipartisan chamber. What he's saying there, though, along with dozens of other claims that he made, was a lie. Those babies were not murdered. There's only one baby that was killed on October 7th, and that was by a stray bullet. We actually don't even know who fired it. But even assuming it was Hamas or another Palestinian militant, all the other claims that Netanyahu put forward about about Israeli babies being killed were just lies. And rather than being called out for it, he was applauded for it.
Yeah, disgusting. And for those who are just listening and not watching, as Aaron said, that was a standing ovation, and there were many of those performed throughout the night. It was really disgusting. And what did the Democrats do? Well, some of them didn't clap. You had Chuck Schumer not shaking his hand, but nodding. You had some of them not coming, which I thought was a stupid decision because it made it look like the people there were supporting him. So it took away from the power of protest. But we had one Democrat who was brave enough to do something actually symbolically powerful. And that person is Rashida Tlaib, who had a fan that said war criminal, and she also wore a keffiyeh. And she was really the only person who expressed the appropriate contempt and disgust for Netanyahu. So shout out to Rashida Tlaib. The question is why there weren't more Democrats doing that. And when Democrats didn't show up, they're not there, so you don't see the people opposing him.
Yeah, a lot of Democrats went out of their way to release statements saying why I'm not coming to Netanyahu's speech, like from Bernie on down. But what does that accomplish to not show up? Okay, you're not there, so therefore you're not there to register your protest. And why is Rashida Tlaib, as you said, the only member of Congress willing to show up and actually challenge him and call him what he is, which is a war criminal? And it's unfair that the only Palestinian member of Congress has this burden on her shoulders on top of all the other burdens she carries as being the only Palestinian member of Congress, that she's alone in being in the room and challenging Netanyahu. I mean, everybody else who boycotted the speech should have been there. To me, it was like a cowardly way of pretending to protest Netanyahu without actually having to do something and doing something that would get, you know, have some political blowback. Because, of course, Israel supporters would have come back and attacked anybody like Rashida Tlaib who confronted Netanyahu. Right. But it's worth it when you have a war criminal being welcomed to Congress. And it's unfortunate that Rashida Tlaib was the only one with the courage to confront him directly.
Right. Now, luckily, we do have some people besides me and Aaron who were appreciative of Rashida Tlaib. Let's take a look at this Code Pink video.
When we were watching Netanyahu giving a speech in Congress yesterday, we saw Rashida Tlaib with her sign saying war criminal. And we were so proud of her and her courage. But we also felt terrible that she was alone there. Nobody sitting by her. A one-woman show telling the truth to the world. And so today we were so excited to go and bring her flowers, bring her a thank you card, and just shower her with the love that millions of us in the U.S. and around the world feel. The whole world saw your courage and how much we appreciate you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you, sister. Rashida. Thank you.
Happy birthday to you.
Making this even more symbolic and more powerful is the fact that this was Rashida Tlaib's birthday. So she was, again, the only person registering protests. She was holding up a fan that said war criminal, and also on the other side said guilty of genocide. And she bears so much responsibility and so much pressure and such a burden, and no one was there to share it with her. And that is why Democrats, except for Rashida Tlaib, suck. Now, we have another Democrat who really sucked this week, John Fetterman. People may have heard of him, may have seen him. He loves wearing hoodies and shorts. That's kind of his shtick. But guess what encouraged him to dress up in a suit for the first time ever? Let's take a look. Here he is listening to Netanyahu and wearing a suit, and Do Dissidents tweeted out, so he does own a suit. He just saves it for when Hitler comes to town. And by the way, there is Kyrsten Sinema wearing a ridiculous outfit. I just had to comment on that. She kind of looks like a cupcake or something. And and then the only thing you have besides Rashida Tlaib, you have Chris Murphy and Alan Warnock sitting down, but that's really not enough. That's not sufficient.
You know, I don't like commenting on people's appearances, but I think when it's an elected lawmaker, we can make an exception because,
sure,
you know, we pay their salary and they're there to represent us. It's so odd that two of the Senate's weirdest addressed people are both there together applauding Netanyahu. There's just something additionally symbolic about that because both these people have some really unique garb that they put on every day. I mean, John Fetterman takes the cake, and it is so funny that he's indeed willing to dress up for Netanyahu and not anything else.
Yeah, it's really pathetic. Like, that's the guy he comes out for, puts on a suit, gets dressed for. Remember that other video we showed them? It was so pathetic. They're like standing next to each other when Fetterman visited Israel, and they're both going like this.
Yes, yes, yes. And Netanyahu called him. He said that you have, like, there's no stronger champion in the U.S. than John Fetterman of Israel. And if that's the case, that's all the more reason for Israel to do some serious soul searching if John Fetterman is the best you can do. For Republicans suck, let's turn back to Benjamin Netanyahu's speech before Congress. The guy who really made this happen, who really was excited to welcome Netanyahu, I think even more than John Fetterman was House Speaker Mike Johnson, Mr. So-called America First, who is always putting Israel first, and especially the most fanatical government Israel's ever had first in Benjamin Netanyahu. So Mike Johnson invited Netanyahu and also threatened to arrest any lawmaker who dared to disrupt Netanyahu's speech, as if Netanyahu was all of a sudden like the leader of the U.S. and not of Israel. And this is how Mike Johnson introduced Netanyahu.
Members of Congress, I now have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel. Thank you.
So you can see how giddy he was to introduce this bloodstained mass murderer and even calling him His Excellency. It's just so humiliating. I don't know what it is that makes these people fall head over heels for Israel, but it's not just AIPAC money. And it's not just the Israeli role as a client state of Israel. In the case of people like Mike Johnson, who is an evangelical Christian, I do think there is something religious about this, where they really do see Israel as fulfilling the prophecy of their beliefs about, you know, of course, one day there being Armageddon, and of course, all the Jews that they claim to care about being slaughtered, except for those who convert. And they see Israel, I think understandably, as pushing them towards that apocalyptic future, because that's what Israel is doing. They're so deranged and criminal. So it's just such a bizarre display, especially for people who call themselves, you know, adherents of America first, always putting Israel first, and even, you know, kissing the feet of a foreign leader inside their own congressional chamber. It's really strange.
Yeah, because that is part of their America First vision. Their America First vision includes the rapture.
Rapture first.
Well, rapture first. Yeah, it. Exactly. They're ready.
They're getting it with Netanyahu.
In more ways than one. Well, for Isn't That Weird, let's take a look at a story about Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance. You may have seen this story making the rounds, and it's really important for us to do a little bit of a an expose about what exactly happened to J.D. Vance or did not happen to J.D. Vance. So first, let's take a look at this AP article. No, J.D. Vance did not have sex with a couch. But if you look on the at the AP right now, you won't see that because they actually took that down. But where does this come from? Well, it turns out, if we go to Snopes, take a little look at Snopes, it explains everything. No, J.D. Vance did not say he had sex with couch cushions. A false online rumor about the former U.S. president, Donald Trump's running mate, a latex glove, and couch cushions spawned a number of jokes and memes. And what happened is that someone tweeted, "Can't say for sure, but he might be the first VP pick to have admitted in a New York Times bestseller to effing an inside-out latex glove shoved between two couch cushions." And then he put in parentheses, "Vance, comma, hillbilly elegy, pages 179 to 181. And this took off like wildfire, and people actually believed it, and it started spreading on the internet to such an extent that the AP had to correct the record and say he did not actually have sex with a couch.
But the AP then took that correction down?
Yes, they took the correction down. I think because they couldn't verify that he had not had sex with a couch, perhaps.
Mm. It's definitely weird. Definitely weird that people felt compelled to fact check a claim that J.D. Vance had sex with a couch. But especially because it's not as if there's not a lot going on in the world right now. But I guess when you're running for vice president,
right,
this is the kind of scrutiny you face. Very weird. Very weird. All right. Isn't that terrible? Let's turn to how Republicans are handling their new challenge. No longer running against a cognitively impaired president, Joe Biden, who can't put a sentence together, who messes up all the time, who is clearly out of it. Now they have Kamala Harris. And whatever you want to say about Kamala Harris is she's not Joe Biden. And I think for Democrats, that can only be a good thing. Now, for Republicans, Kamala Harris presents a particular challenge because she's a woman of color and she's in a position of power and they have to defeat her in an election. And Republicans often are known for chauvinism, for mocking people based on their identity. And the question or the challenge I think they face now is, can they contain themselves in running against a woman of color in Kamala Harris? And so far, they're having a really hard time, and they're having a hard time not sticking to talking points that I just don't think are going to land with the voters they need to reach. So here, for example, is Ted Cruz of Texas.
Kamala can't have my guns, she can't have my gasoline engine, and she sure as hell can't have my steaks and cheeseburgers. She is a radical California leftist, and to be honest, she perfectly captures where today's Democrat Party is.
All right, so in fairness to Ted Cruz, he's not really mocking her identity there. He's just sticking to familiar MAGA, you know, from my cold dead hands, kind of NRA talking points. But he's expanding it beyond guns to gasoline engines and also steaks and cheese and cheeseburgers. Is that Democrats are coming for steaks and cheeseburgers with, a vegan agenda. He calls her a radical California left Democrat. I mean,
yeah.
For people who count themselves on the left or the radical left, I don't think they would count Kamala Harris, who was a prosecutor, who is heavily tied to Silicon Valley. Her brother-in-law, for example, works for Uber, I believe. and who's, you know, been a pretty reliable neoliberal for her political career, I don't think that they would count her as one of their own if you're on the radical left.
I would agree. But it's important to get out in front of the cheeseburger myth. So or the cheeseburger talking point. So I think that Ted Cruz may have done Kamala a favor, much like that tweeter created a rumor about J.D. Vance having sex with a couch, and the AP had to debunk that. Now Kamala can make sure that people don't think she is actually going after their cheeseburgers.
All right, so this one's even more strange. This is Fox News host Jesse Waters, and this is his claim about why even Kamala Harris was vice president to begin with.
The only reason Kamala's in the White House is because of the DEI deal Biden cut with Bernie to seal the nomination.
So this is a new one. I haven't heard this before. Apparently, Kamala Harris was chosen at the behest of Bernie Sanders as part of his effort to impose a DEI agenda on Biden, which is the first I've heard of that. Bernie Sanders, of course, is not known for being a fan of Kamala Harris. They don't really share much in the way of policy positions. Bernie Sanders, for example, has not even endorsed Kamala Harris yet because he wants to make sure that she embraces policies that support the working class, which she hasn't yet. So Jesse Waters wants us to think that Kamala Harris was put there at the behest of Bernie in order to push his DEI agenda, which that's the first I've heard of that one.
Yeah, it's funny because Bernie Sanders was always unfairly attacked for being terrible on identity politics. And now apparently he's a DEI guy.
Bernie really can't win, you know. He's blamed for everybody blames him. Like Hillary Clinton blames him for 2016. And now Fox News is blaming him for Kamala Harris being VP. I mean, it's tough to be Bernie.
It's tough to be Bernie indeed. And those are your four basic food groups. This week, we're very excited to be joined by Mohammed El Kurd, who is a writer and poet from Jerusalem, Occupy Palestine. And he is the culture editor at Mondo Weiss. And we're going to start off by talking to him about a satirical video that he made with Morgan Beseeches, who is a great activist and organizer and artist and part of Jewish Voice for Peace.
And Mohammed El Kurd is from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem and became known around the world when he took part in resisting a takeover, a theft of his family home by Israeli settlers as part of a wider attempt by Israel and the settlers to steal Palestinian land in East Jerusalem.
Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You did a really great collaboration video with Morgan Beseeches that was kind of satirizing the way that Palestinians are interrogated by the media.
I want to start by asking you, actually, I don't want to ask, I want to tell you.
Tell me.
I want to read to you something from a very credible news platform.
What's the very credible?
It's the Times of Israel.
Uh-huh.
So it's a very, I think it's won the Pulitzer. Now, here's the quote.
Can you tell people what inspired you to do that in the first place?
Yeah, ever since this genocidal onslaught on Gaza started, it's become more and more circus-like, being a Palestinian in the media sphere. It almost feels like gimmicky, and it feels like it's being done for entertainment values. But at the same time, you know, we are told to respond to these kind of ridiculous accusations that we're met with, these kind of interrogations. We're kind of told to take them seriously, to respond to them in good faith, when in reality, when you're responding to them in good faith, you're kind of giving them power over you. And when you're satirizing them, when you're kind of dismissing them, tossing them, that you are in fact flipping the script and like turning the terms of engagement in your own favor. And it kind of teaches the audience at home something. It kind of like inspires them and incentivizes them to be more flippant, to be more irreverent, to refuse these kinds of investigations and interrogations, because, you know, it's nuts to be witnessing a literal genocide of people, to be witnessing the literal burning of our people's flesh and be asked hypothetical questions about a so-called second Holocaust or chance calling for a second Holocaust. And because the Holocaust is, you know, such a taboo, such you know, a profound atrocity, we somehow respond to the accusations of a second Holocaust with that same seriousness. But when you satirize it, you kind of unseat, you displace what's not serious, and you recenter what's actually serious, what's actually morally abject, which is the actual ongoing material genocide of the Palestinian people happening in the present tense.
And was there someone in particular, like a certain media figure in particular, who inspired this, or who Morgan was impersonating?
No, it was just it was a cacophony of a bunch of people. I mean, we did the pun in the beginning of the video where it was like Pierce Moore, and then we changed it to appears more than needed. But there was just a pun of different people. Morgan is just an amazing improv actor, and they were just kind of extremely witty and like coming up with things on the spot, and that's how the character came into life.
Morgan is also an incredible rally speaker. I've gone to rallies where Morgan is addressing the crowd, and they just are so powerful in stirring up emotion, which is a skill in itself, which very few people have. Yeah, that's my interjection.
No, and it was very funny. I was worried because I like your work and Morgan's work, but as everyone knows, I think comedy can be a little hit or miss, especially when politics are involved. And so I was really relieved that it was so funny. Just like always happens when you see like your friend perform stand up or something for the first time.
Yeah, I think there's still, it was my first attempt at such a thing. I think Morgan really like carried the humor a great bit. And there, you know, it could have been done better, but I just really wanted to. We do so many reports and we do so many PowerPoint presentations and so many infographics, and we don't really touch the irreverent. We don't really like toe the line, and I just wanted to try it.
And what was also interesting is that you opened the interview, this satire of an interview, with by analyzing real things that you said, and that's the jumping off point. Yeah, can you for people who haven't seen the video, can you explain the first thing that you're talking about with the interviewer?
Yeah, it was I was at Duke University one time, and I had given a speech at Duke, and then obviously the very famous, great, inventive, amazing, original question was asked: what happens to the settlers? And I just said I don't give a shit. And it was like all over the news afterwards. And I've never responded to any of those like controversies, I guess, be it at Duke University, Arizona State University, like when I was in law. There's a lot of things I say either get taken out of context or, you know, get centered. And I never respond to them because I believe like they're distractions. So I wanted to kind of use the video as an opportunity to respond, because if I were to respond in the media, it would just bolster the situation, kind of like a Streisand effect. And I don't think the media would be quoting me in good faith. You know, I would say, you know, like I said this because, or like I answered this question because I want to show you how ridiculous this question is. So I answered it this way. You asked me about what happens to the settlers, but you're not really concerned about what happens to the refugees. But none of this actually makes it to the media. Usually the media is corporate media, just wants to demonize you. So I've just had the approach to just ignore, and I thought I wanted the video to have a narrative. So I thought starting with the quote in the Times of Israel was a great thing. I think it's a funny thing that, you know, their articles are written about things we say, and our articles are written about the bombs they drop.
When Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, he already had 3 missed calls from Chuck Norris.
We all know the man, the myth, and the legend of Chuck Norris. But did you know that in his 80s, he's still alive and kicking butt? Either that, or death is too afraid to tell him the news. Chuck wants to share with you what gives him so much energy to work out, stay active, and keep up with his grandkids. He did this just by making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s.
And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful.
This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As a Palestinian who has been attacked by settlers and you've had your house stolen from you, how does it feel to have your safety totally ignored by the mainstream media and the discussion of safety to revolve around people's feelings, like feeling unsafe at a protest or something?
It's nuts. It almost feels like you're in somebody's hallucination, and it's. We look at it, you look at it, I think of, like, I tell myself, you know, I'm tough, or like, we're tougher than them. And so, like, the racism we encounter, the discursive rhetorical racism we encounter, we don't really say much about, because we're dealing with actual bombs, or actual occupation with colonialism. We tell ourselves, you know, like, getting strip searched, or dealing with this or that, or like being pulled aside at the airport, it's not that big of a deal, because there are people who are being bombed. So like, lots of the racism we encounter gets shoved to the margins. But I think what's really insidious, what's very extremely pernicious, is the fact that we even give those feelings of unsafety, or these, when people who live in high-rise apartments who have trust funds are like, oh, I'm scared to go on campus. When we give them the time of day, when we indulge them, I think that's extremely pernicious and dangerous. And I think it gives them more heft than they warrant. And it reinforces a status quo in which Zionist feelings are elevated over the material reality of Palestinians, a material reality that is defined by systemic policies of colonial violence.
You visited some of the college encampments that we recently saw against the Gaza genocide. What was that experience like for you?
It was very incredible to see. It felt at times vindicating, the kind of unabashed tone of the students. Also, there was an atmosphere of debate within the encampments, where like different—I don't want to call them fractions, but different people have different approaches to activism and organizing. And I thought it was quite refreshing to see that there is multiple approaches to things, and that people are engaging in a useful debate. There was a lot of talk about, you know, how like Muslims and Christians and Jews all pray together at the encampments. I find this a little bit less interesting to me, because it kind of reinforces the idea that this is like a religious conflict of some sorts. But other than that, it was just really incredible that the students stood their grounds. And, you know, we joke, or I joke, I make fun of Ivy League students all the time. I say these people are pampered and spoiled. And to see that these people, in fact, put their bodies on the line, their careers on the line, it showcased incredible courage in the face of administrations that are rabid almost. It's really incredible, and it gives me hope, you know what I mean? And I think it communicated also to people back home that the United States is a complicated, place. It's not just that there is 300 million people who are invested in our death, but in fact, there's a struggle within that country that not only is interested in fighting for Palestinian freedom, but there are people who are fighting for their own freedom, for their healthcare, for their housing, for so on and forth. So I think the symbolic value of the encampments is, priceless. And I think not only symbolic, I think there's been lots of like cultural victories that we have obtained out of those encampments that we are yet to see. Of course, another reading could be, you know, disappointment that there hasn't been divestment, but it's a bit, I think, I don't want to call it naive, but it would be a bit silly to expect these institutions to budge so easily when they're literally like financed by the war machine.
And for people who aren't familiar with your story, you became known around the world for fighting an Israeli takeover of your family home as part of a wider land grab in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. I'm wondering if you could talk to us about, you know, how that impacted you and what is the latest in that struggle?
I just come from a community of hundreds of people who have, like, by choice or by force, dedicated their lives to fighting against settler colonialism, Zionist colonialism, by U.S.-based and U.S.-led settler organizations that are backed by the Israeli judiciary. And, you know, I grew up around these kinds of campaigns. And in 2020, when we had the most recent wave of expulsion orders from the Israeli courts, I came back home. I was studying in New York, and I came back home. And, you know, it was like thousands of people from all over Palestine and internationals who were, like, involved in this campaign. And I think we just approached it a little bit different in terms of the rhetoric and in terms of the discursive battles we were waging. And we had some victories. Most of the expulsion orders have been canceled. Of course, there are still members of our community that are still in legal battles, quote unquote legal battles. We know they're primarily political battles. And we know that, you know, everything is volatile and things can change. And we also know that even though our houses were safe, there's hundreds of homes in the wider Jerusalem and in the West Bank, not to mention the homes in Gaza that have been, you know, destroyed by the Zionist regime. So it's an ongoing battle.
And for people who aren't familiar with who these settlers are, these people who come from, you know, places like Brooklyn and claim ownership of your home because it's biblically prophesized or whatever it is. What is it like to deal with them, to see them face to face?
If I didn't live that life, I would not believe it. It's like almost cartoonish. I was watching videos from my childhood, you know, when we were younger. We had a human rights organization give us, like, handheld cameras to record. And I was watching videos from my childhood. And, you know, we would have busloads, every week, busloads of American Jews come into our front yard and sing their religious songs and, like, scream their expletives at us, spit at us. I remember this old Jewish woman who would, like, scream in my face, told me I was a murderer. And they would, like, look at us and our homes, not only us but our neighbors, like, they would look at us as they were at an auction for zoo animals. And that's how it felt. And it is beyond absurd that this happens, and it happens in a great deal. It is done by America. Like, it's hard to you say it, and I don't think people recognize the absurdity of it, but it's these are American people who decide to leave their lives behind to come and get paid in many cases by settler organizations that are based in the New York State area in the United States to live in our homes, to terrorize us. You know, like, I don't want to dwell too much on it, but we grew up with, like, settlers doing all kinds of sexual harassment, verbal abuses, and they're always protected by police. It's not like you can pick up a stone or, like, pick up a stick and fight them or, like, do anything, because you would be shot in an instant. And not only is this thing defended by the likes of American politicians and, like, many portions of the Jewish community in this country and Christian Zionists in this country, but it's subsidized. Like, if you look at New York State, New York State taxpayers unknowingly subsidize these organizations. There's a great campaign that's ongoing. It started, I think, at the beginning of last year, called Not on Our Dime, where certain organizations, human rights organizations, and legislator Zohran Mamdani are trying to make it illegal to take away the tax exempt status from these organizations. Forgive me, I lost my wording.
And how did you, by the way, on a related note, how did you get into poetry?
My mother is a poet, or was a poet, and just poetry is like a great, it's a great tradition in the Palestinian culture, maybe less so now, but it's always been just like a part of our culture. And it's, I think when you're like a boring kid who doesn't do sports, you're like, you need to find the hobby to become interesting. I think it was just the thing that I decided to land on. And it was just, it's just natural. I think Arabic is very, very extremely poetic. We're very emotive people. We exaggerate a lot in the way we speak. And that's just very correct for poetry.
And does it give you catharsis? Like, not just artistic, but I guess political catharsis?
I don't write poetry anymore, or not as much as I used to. But yes, it's like, ultimately, in English especially, it allows you to say things that you would not be allowed to say in articles, like that you would have to wage battles against your editors to say. But I will say that even in the realm of poetry, I think the standard for Palestinians is a bit higher, is extremely higher. There's like a double standard. And what I mean by this is, you know, like, I couldn't just write poems. You know, I'm like, the ADL, for example, would always come after me for poems and lines in my book. And the ADL would never say that these were poems or lines for poems. It would just say, like, he said so-and-so. And it would be, you know, very, very out of regards. I've never really addressed it, but it's interesting to see that even in the metaphorical, even in the abstract, there's a policing. Like, the Zionist mind works to police us, even in the abstract. And I think it's funny if it wasn't so evil.
Yeah, and of course, another example of that is the disgusting attacks on Rafat al-Arir, even after he was killed in a targeted attack, a targeted bombing by Israel. We actually had him on a few months before that. But the way that people vilified him, and before he was killed, he pointed the finger at Barry Weiss for the way that she singled him out over a ridiculous comment, like tweet that he made that was a joke, not based on violence. It was a joke based on ridiculous claims, and kind of goes back to what you were saying, Mohammed, before about how, you know, the violence people care about is like discursive. It's not about, like, this man was literally blown up, blown into bits through a bomb, as was his sister and her family. And yet people after that were talking about what he had said in a tweet. Someone even said to me when I was talking about him, this is just a little personal side, but I shared something about him on a listserv, and someone was like, well, Katie, you didn't say that he had said he would throw his pens at Israeli soldiers. Like, I'm not even kidding you. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, that tweet you mentioned is part of the reason why I wanted to do that video with Morgan. I think Rifat was a force of nature, and it's the whole situation is quite ridiculous, because first of all, we know of documented cases of Palestinian, at least one case of a Palestinian baby being thrown into an oven during the Deir Yassin massacre during the Nakba. And then you have this fabricated story about Palestinian fighters doing the same for an Israeli kid. So, you know, there's that, it invokes that sentiment of every accusation is a confession. And then Rifat says, with or without a baking powder. I think it's hilarious. I also think we're just allowed to say things, bad or good or evil or horrible. It's just, it's nuts that you, this person that you mentioned even had a problem with the pen, right? Like, even we lower our ceilings so much. Rifat didn't say, like, oh, I would throw a hand grenade at the soldiers. I would throw my pen. And even, we live in a world where we're expected to be not pacifist, pacified, fully pacified. We're expected to turn the other cheek. We're expected also to not have any affiliations with violence or violent organizations. For example, you know, Jewish Insider recently ran a story that said that 30% of journalists killed in the Gaza war were affiliated by Hamas, as if that makes killing them acceptable. And then the Israeli Defense Forces, the Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson had said also in an earlier statement that there is no difference between working for Al-Aqsa TV channel, which is a Hamas-based, Hamas-controlled TV channel, the government, basically the state TV, and working for Hamas armed wing. And that was just, and then you have the New Yorker recently running an article by Masha Gessen, where they, among many other things, they quote this is lefty Israeli journalist who describes the Israeli soldiers as our children, our sons. You have, you know, New York Times correspondents who have children in the Israeli military. You have editors of U.S. magazines like The Atlantic who were previously jailers, who volunteered to leave the United States to become jailers. And none of that is a cause for a conflict of interest. None of that is scrutinized. And yet our very, like, feeling and sentiment is constantly on trial, whether we want to throw a pen or whether we hate these people or whether we want to make a joke online. And I think we should just completely reject that. It's ridiculous. They are never held to the same standards that we are held to. And the fact that we even concede to their standards is nuts.
I'm just thinking of the, you know, 20 years ago or over 20 years ago, there was a huge controversy when Edward Said threw a stone over the Lebanon-Israeli border in the direction of Israeli soldiers. And he had lectures canceled. He was widely denounced for literally just throwing a stone. And, you know, doing it symbolically, of course. But that was like a huge controversy that, like, where people tried to make him apologize. It was, you know, so, of course, it continues now. And the New York Times, a longtime correspondent, I'm not sure if they still own the home, but they lived in a stolen Palestinian home in East Jerusalem. Yeah.
Yeah, the entanglements are just like endless. And that story you mentioned about Edward Said is so interesting. I'm actually writing about it in my book now. But it's just nuts. The kind of what's even more interesting than the cancellation of his lectures were the essays that followed, written by his former students or written by colleagues who were like genuinely or like parodying genuine like fear for their lives. And you read it and you want to punch them in the face, because you're sitting in New York, what are you afraid of? And it's this constant manufacturing of fear that we have to coddle all the time and concede to, that we should just not anymore.
And what are your thoughts on the debate around Trump versus the Democrat? I mean, you have some people obviously saying the Democrats are terrible on this, they're genocidal, and Trump is going to be worse. Then you have some people saying, no, genocide is genocide, and Biden or the Democrats should be punished for this.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was a really great and moving and inspiring interview with Mohammed.
Great to talk to him. He's part of a new generation of younger Palestinian voices who have really informed a lot of people and inspired a lot of people around the world about the plight of their people. And it's great to talk to him.
Thanks so much for watching Useful Idiots, listening to Useful Idiots. Make sure you join us at usefulidiotspodcast.com to get bonus content like Thursday Throwdown and extended interviews. Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.